Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to In The Pink, the podcast with me, Natalie Pinkham. Now, first and foremost, I want to say a big thank you for all the lovely feedback on the Claire Williams podcast. It was a real pleasure to chat to Claire. You know, she's had a tough time recently with the team languishing at the back of the grid, and I think I speak for all of us when I say that we wish her the best and we hope Williams are back at the front where they belong very soon. Claire is such a great role model, a trailblazer in fact, for women, not just in Formula One, but in business and beyond. And I want to say thank you from a personal point of view as well, because, you know, sometimes I'm completely knackered and I'm trying to spin too many plates as a working mum, and I drop a few. And actually chatting to Claire kind of really inspired me and boosted me and made me want to keep pushing and work harder. So thank you so much, Claire. Okay, next up on In The Pink, it is Nick Doherty. Now, many of you will know Nick from the world of golf. He was an incredibly talented young golfer with the world at his feet, a long career stretching out in front of him. Until one tragic day, his mum died very suddenly at a very young age. And it sent Nick into a spin. His game basically unraveled. In fact, it was such an extraordinary case of the yips. He went from winning tournaments to barely being able to hit a ball. On this podcast, he talks candidly about the process of rebuilding and trying to sort of redefine himself in many ways, because golf is all he's ever known. And he's done that to great effect. So I think Nick will be a true inspiration for many of you listening. I certainly loved our time together. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Doherty on In The Pink. Well, Nick, here we are at your gorgeous golf club, Wentworth. I don't know whether I'm just, you know, harking back to yesteryear here, but I remember coming to a golf club with my grandfather years ago, and I wasn't allowed to step over a line into a separate bar area because no girls, no women were allowed. Is it at all like that anymore?
No. Okay, no, good. Wentworth's great like that. The cool thing about Wentworth that makes it a bit different is that I was used to going to those sorts of golf clubs as a junior, and as a junior you didn't get treated very well back in the day. Golf has changed quite a lot since. There's still a few clubs that are a bit old-fashioned, but this isn't one of them. So we're actually at the moment discussing internally with the membership, and well, not me, that makes it sound like I'm in part of that discussion. I'm one of the members that's voiced an opinion as well on whether or not we can wear denim at the club, which is, some people would scoff at that in golfing background because it just doesn't fit with the tradition. But if you want it to make it a truly social club, that people come for a pint here and come for a drink at night and a bite to eat, and it is like that, the vibe here is very social. You need to make it so that people can come wherever they are, you know. So that's one of the things they've done. I mean, it's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, it's got an amazing history. We're in the Curtis Cup room here, and we've had all sorts of events here, including the Ryder Cup. We have the PGA here every year as well. It's really cool. It's a massively. I was trying to think how I would bill it as a. It's a ultimate luxury item being a member at Wentworth because it's not something that's cheap for people, but you get to experience something pretty awesome all the time. I'm very lucky to be an ambassador for him.
I can tell.
I can put a word in for you, but I don't know if it'll help.
No, I'm past any kind of help when it comes to golf. Although I have to say, going back to my grandfather, he was a scratch golfer and I think would have been immensely proud had I followed in his footsteps, either me or my brother, or actually he has four daughters, he's passed away now, but so even if any of them had followed in his footsteps, I'm sure he would have loved it. He wrote books about golf, for God's sake.
Really?
And none of us had, well, I don't know, but sort of just golfing related.
That's
good, though. Yeah, yeah. But I think we've sort of a massive disappointment to him, really. I'm sorry about that, Grandpa.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a difficult sport, isn't it? Because it takes loads of time.
Yeah.
It's not one you can dabble with. So I noticed this with my brother, because my brother Marcus is a real hotshot in New York. And he's a brilliant, brilliant corporate lawyer, right at the top of his trade. But he plays golf occasionally, and our whole family has always golfed. And to say he's the worst in the family doesn't do it justice to quite how bad he is compared to the rest of us, because my mum was half decent, my dad was a really good golfer, and of course I played on tour. But he dabbles, so he will play like five times a year, and he looks like he's played five times a year as well. And he has this massive amount of confidence in his job that he does, which is for telephone numbers in terms of money that he deals in. But then on a golf course, three people would be watching him and he'll pick his ball up and put it in his pocket because he's too nervous to hit in front of him. And it's just funny, isn't it? If you haven't got the time to give to this and you don't see improvement and it doesn't always come quickly, people can get really frustrated and sometimes just knock it on the head. It's a tough one.
I think, I know my dad always says that Ness's going to be the best at something, he doesn't want to do it at all. And that's same with him for golf, because can commit the time. So what is your earliest golfing memory?
My earliest golfing memory would be, I won an under 14s competition in Scotland as a 6-year-old. Yeah, as a 6-year-old, I was at North Berwick, and it was on on this little course that's still there apparently. I'm desperate to take Di there with the kids, but she keeps putting it off because she's so in love with St Andrews. And it's got this beautiful little par 3 course. Like, it's a children's course, really, outside the back of the hotel, which is attached to a very famous course in North Berwick. But I won. But they didn't give me the trophy. So we went to the prize giving, and of course, there's all the age groups all the way through, and I was right, the youngest, obviously. And then the mate, all the older lads, so the under 15 level, whatever, under 14 was the top level. The score was called out for the lad who won, and it was worse than my score. But they obviously just hadn't looked down through it, because there's no way a 6-year-old's going to be in the running, right, to win. So it was in the paper, and my dad still got the clip in at home, and they made me a trophy. It was called the Affleck Cup. I got it, 1988, I won that. So that was my earliest, and I say I remember that because I remember the golf course. I don't remember winning the competition particularly, but I remember the golf course, and I've got all the pictures of it. But all my golfing memories at the start were pretty much from Scotland. My whole family played. My dad got into it because he was in the motor trade. And, you know, we've got a very humble backgrounds from Liverpool and Wales for my mum. But my dad, when he started doing well for himself in the motor trade, he realised that loads of business was getting done through golf and he was missing out. So I better learn how to play this game. And, you know, he might have found a golf club somewhere and he got into it, and his love for it grew from there, and he's played his whole life, and hence we all have since as well.
And so what, you just followed in his footsteps, but you obviously had a natural ability as well.
Bootle Municipal was the golf course I learnt at, which is, I'm wary of saying this, because I think I wear it like a badge of honour, but you used to have to hook the strap of your golf bag around your leg when you were hitting a shot. Because they might get nicked. Like, people, if you weren't from the area and you weren't used to it, I mean, it's probably changed a lot now. But when I was a little boy and dad would take me there, and he'd play and I'd just follow around with the club, you could tell people who weren't from the area who hadn't played there, because they'd go and leave their clubs on the next tee and then walk to the green to putt, and there's no way they were getting back there in time before someone would come out of the bushes, clubs off in the car, down the back road. Yeah. Like, yeah, it was great. But it was brilliant, and I used to love it. And I always remember hot oxtail soups as a kid there on a Saturday and Sunday with my dad. You'd turn up at 6:30 in the summertime on a Saturday morning, it'd be packed. They'd all be queuing because they love the golf, and cheap and cheerful. And that's where I learnt the game, on Bootle Municipal. And it was great. And we lived there. I was born on Bailey Drive, which is right by the golf course there. And, you know, the only reason we left Liverpool was for me, because when I was 11 years old and going to go to secondary school, I don't really remember this. Dad made it his vision that's what I was going to be. I was going to be a golfer. I mean, at 11, you don't know that, do you? I was thinking about transports.
Well, he decided at that point. that you're already going to be?
I think he thought I was good. Yeah. I was clear because I beat everyone. So when I was 11 years old, I was already playing off about 8 handicap, which is unheard of. Yeah, and because I mean, 11 years old, you're a kid, aren't you? I mean, you're a little kid. But it would be funny because you go and play with people who play golf for a long time, and I'd beat them, right? And the only thing I was missing was age, maturity, size, and distance. So I couldn't reach. Obviously, that's where the handicap was. Actually, my short game was really, really good. So we moved to Chorley so that I could live. We lived in the gate of Shore Hill Golf Club so that I could come home from school and go straight out onto the golf course to practice every day without needing anyone to drive me anywhere. So that's why we moved from Liverpool in the first place, which was a massive, quite a lot of pressure actually, but I don't think at the time I really thought about it like that. But I mean, they effectively moved everything they'd ever known to Chorley to live in a golf club for me so I could play every day. And my life as a kid, and this is why it's funny because I hear Di will talk about school and our schoolmates, and I haven't got that many old school friends. I have one really close one, a couple that I stay in touch with, but one really close one. Other than that, I don't stay in touch with any of them because my memory of school was I get up in the morning, go to the bus stop, bus to school, come back from school, change into my golf clothes, out onto the golf course with Dad until it went dark, whenever that was. Or if it was in the winter, to the driving range for 2 or 3 hours every night after school, come back, do my homework, eat my dinner, go to bed, rinse and repeat. Then on a Saturday and Sunday, I'd go and play competitions. And I was actually a member at Formby Golf Club. I actually got in there after we left from the area, ironically. But that was my memory. So those days for me weren't all that amazing. I mean, the whole sort of, I had such a sheltered life through my school years. But it's arguably what had to happen. I didn't know any different. And Dad was really, really hard on me. We had it was a more of a business relationship than a father-son relationship. And a lot of it was ruled through fear. And Dad was super hard on me. I admire it and also, to a degree, resent it, you know, because his vision, he wouldn't have liked that. And we've chatted about this since at different times, but he got no kicks out of saying no and that I couldn't have those things that other kids have, because he thought all along, I will give you the thing that these kids will never get. You know, I'll give you the opportunity to have a lifestyle and have something that these other children won't get, because if you do what is the norm, you will get the norm, and what you're trying to do is extraordinary. And of course, when you're 13 years old, I mean, I'm like, yeah, sure, I mean, I'm perving on Rachel and friends, aren't I? I mean, that's what I'm really thinking about at that age. I mean, that's where the happiness is. And I just remember it was a slog. It was a real slog. I didn't really love the game until I started making national teams. And I think that's really, really that I knew I had something a bit special when I started playing for my county, and I was playing for the men's team when I was 14 years old, and which is unusual. I'm playing for the England team when I'm 16 years old, which again is unusual for men's teams.
Incredibly. So were you playing out his? It sounds like he had a very clear goal for you, and he was almost living vicariously. Would that be fair?
I don't think it is probably fair to him that no. Which is unusual because it's common that, obviously, for parents to live through the children. But it really wasn't. I think because he'd fought so hard, and Dad's way of making it in his life, he was a mechanic, and he somehow managed to get his way into the sales room as a scouter, like properly, like a scally, and you know, he a grafter, but he was he didn't have anything, you know. His dad's a docker. My nan, who's still alive, was an ice cream saleswoman, and or she worked in an ice cream shop in Southfields, ironically, years ago. That's where my dad's from down here. And the background was very, very humble, and he got everything he had by fighting for every inch and having to do whatever he had to.
So he wanted you to do the same.
He wanted to make it was tough because he knew that's one of the things he had to fight for. So the only way he knew how was to be really hard and to push and fight for everything and make it make things happen. And golf's a bit different to that. It doesn't necessarily, and as I found later on in my career, it doesn't always work that way. But I think for him, it was all he knew. So if it didn't work, he'd tear into me and give me a hard time. And, you know, I was bloody nervous being around him sometimes. You know, I'd be physically quite intimidating. very sad. You know, it gave me a real hard time. It was really tough. And as I said, I admire the fact that how that would have made him feel to do that, but his motives for doing it. But at the same time, I could never do it with my children. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think he knows this, because I wrote this to him in a letter, but which I won't really talk about. But we had to come together at some stage, because there's too much water under the bridge with my dad and I. And he achieved his goal, right? I mean, I got on tour at 19 years of age. I was living the life that kids could only dream of. 19-year-olds don't live the way I was living. But it made for a very difficult time. And Mum was the peacekeeper, you know, the one who sort of tried to keep it all together and make sure that, you know, the arguments were fixed and, you know, tell him sometimes, okay, I think you've been a little bit too much on him there. And it was, it made for an interesting childhood.
Yeah, I was going to ask what she was saying while all this was going on, because it can't have been easy for her, you know, married to your dad and respectful of his views, but obviously wanting to nurture you and give you the fullest childhood you could have.
Yeah, I think to a degree she knew what Dad was doing, and Dad is one of those people, he still is that man. It's amazing, actually. He is that man, and when he's gone, touch wood is a long time away, wherever wood is, something's made of wood here, I'll feel a lot more vulnerable. He is the guy, if he said it's going to be all right, it's going to be all right. Mm. You know, and he's the only man I've ever met that made me feel that. I wouldn't trust, and because I'm a bit of a control freak, if someone says it's going to be all right, I need to know it's all right myself. Mm. I need to sort it myself, and I think I get that from my dad. And if he said it was going to be okay, it was going to be okay. Mm. And I trust him that much, and I think Mum just thought he knows what he's doing.
Is golf the sort of sport that you can just apply that, the outliers theory of 10,000 hours, and get that good? Or did he see something very special in you as early as 5 or 6?
I don't know. I find it was such a weird... It's an interesting debate, the 10,000 hours one. I think it's necessary, but I think it also helps to have a combination of that with some innate talent and passion for a sport. I think if it comes from within... Mm. Great sports people, the ones that, and you've spent time around loads as well as I have, they have that in common. There's something different about the way that they work, and ironically, when they're retired, they talk about it more openly, because they sort of show that little bit that was different, because they had that sort of, they operate in a different way, especially when it's under pressure. And I was always very good in that regard. I got the very most out of myself when I needed it the most, until I lost all of that when later on in my career. But I think with my dad, he sort of taught me and had me believe that I was always going to be all right. And as much as he was so hard on me, I also felt like I was never, ever playing anyone that I wasn't going to beat. I really believed that whoever I played, I would beat. And all my wins on tour, ironically, were against players who I was supposed to lose to. So it was always big names. When I was the main name, I never did that well, because I always felt uncomfortable. My expectations got my own way, whereas when I had someone to strive for, and it's that sort of, he's got something I want. I was really good in that situation.
Underdog.
I love being the underdog. I was always very good in that situation, and I think a lot of that came from Dad and the way he taught me. And inevitably, he got me to. I put the hard yards in. I had a certain amount of talent as well that went with it. But something that always bothered him, it bothers me a little bit as well, is. When people talk about, oh, he's just so gifted, it's such a frustrating, naive, and ignorant mentality for people to have towards sports people. They probably put more into that than you could ever imagine. Not you personally, I mean in general, people who aren't around those sorts of people all the time. You are, but you only see on TV when you watch sports people, you see those images, you think, oh, I'd love a bit of that. Would you though? Would you really want to do what he or she did to get there? Would you be able to do that when you had a choice to do something else? The easy choice is never the right choice, usually, in those situations. And I recognise that now when I watch the guys and still do it. I sometimes, because I'm there at the events, I think, oh, God, maybe I shouldn't have stopped. But I think, hang on a minute, that's not doing justice to just how good they are and just how hard it was when I didn't have what I used to have to be able to compete at that level anymore. It's they're at the very best of the best for a reason. The reason they're on the TV screens every week, and the reason they make the money that they make, the very top athletes, is because it's really, really hard to get there. Mm. And 99.9% of people don't. And in our sport, 99% of people end up in the pro shop. Or one of my best mates, Bill. I used to say he's a Mars bar salesman. He's not, but that was the old joke, you know, with people who you'd have a give them a bit of needle over the fact that, you know, you didn't make it as a player, so you end up selling Mars bars. Of course, they don't. There's much more to it. They're business people. They teach. They do all sorts of wonderful things and grow the game. But usually, nearly all of those people had aspirations of being tour players because they didn't wake up and think, God, I really want to be the head pro at this golf club. They woke up thinking, I want to beat him, I want to hole a putt to win the Open, or I want to, you know, win on this tour, or be that guy, or live in this house. And to live in this house, I'll need to be able to play at this level. And whatever it was, the motivation, it was usually to play at the highest level, and very few make it.
What did your brother make of all of this? Because Marcus is older than you, but did he feel like you were the sort of chosen younger son?
Dad tried to get him to be a golfer as well, but he's terrible. He's terrible at golf. He really is terrible at golf, but he's bloody good at business and very academic. I was academic as well, but Marcus followed it through, went to university in London, and the rest is history. I left when I was 16, though, so I did really well in my GCSEs. And then I was going to actually go to university when I was 17 in America. I scored really highly on the SATs. I could have gone pretty much anywhere, full scholarship. But my mum had said, because she's very academic, she'd said, if you go, you have to finish your degree. I was going to do a degree in psychology because it was relevant, purely because it was relevant to what I did. To be honest, I did well in school, but I didn't, as I said, I didn't like school. It's not a happy time for me particularly. So, but going to America and playing golf, and it was like, this seems great. And back then it was sort of the go-to thing to do, go in the college system, you know, warm weather training, really high quality competition to be against. And mum said I had to stay and finish it. I had no intention of doing that. I was going to turn pro well before then. So I knocked it on the head. And at 16, I was a full-time golfer, playing all the amateur events. And the funny thing now when I look at that, I didn't bat an eyelid. But what if it hadn't worked out?
Yeah.
And no qualifications. Saying, oh,
you'd
I did
being
really
a pro
well,
at the
I
golf really, shop.
Well, I would have been selling Mars bars, wouldn't I? But it really does an injustice to what they do. No. If you're a club pro, I admire you greatly. But tip that one around the post. No, but if it hadn't worked out, I had no qualifications. You know, I don't know what I'd have done because I wouldn't have wanted to do that because I'm a really creative person, and being in the golf club would have been or teaching people for a living. I enjoy doing what I do now with the bits and bobs I do through social media, but I'm not a golf coach. I'm not born to do that.
No, I don't know. Well, look, more on that later, because I actually think you are a very good teacher. And I think that's part of why you're very good on screen. You're a pundit and you explain the game in layman's terms. You kind of make it accessible, which is a key to being a good teacher, surely. But anyway, everything changed when your mum died. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, well, I was at the peak of my powers, really. Or certainly I was moving in the right direction. I was one of the top 50 in the world and playing my first Masters. And my mum and dad were there. And it was the weirdest week ever. And because mum and dad didn't come and watch me play, because dad couldn't watch me play because of the whole sort of, he couldn't help it, even as an adult. I couldn't help myself. I'd watch him down the side of the fairway and he'd be like, oh, he's doing this. He'd be doing all sorts of funny moves, like, because he's annoyed that I did a bad or make a bogey or whatever. So he never came. But I said,
come. Did you ask him not to come?
Or I didn't want him to come and he didn't like it. He didn't like it. And again, like, that's the whole point. He didn't mean any of this. He meant so much to him. That was the thing. And of course, the members of the golf club used to drive him wild. He could say, oh, see, your lad missed the cut. He says, oh, it's just after people need to go and get in the car and drive home because he couldn't handle it. And of course, as you know, and we all know in this world, there's plenty of that where you have to be able to sort of in one and out the other with sometimes fans or public or people who want to let you know their opinions. But the funny thing was at the Masters, he came and they watched me. And on the second day, I was doing quite well. And in Amen Corner at Augusta is a very obviously well-known area of Augusta National, one of the most famous parts of a golf course you'll ever hear about. And I hit a ball. I made a mistake and I dropped two shots, with cutting the story short. I dropped a couple of shots and I was in trouble now. And then I birdied four of the last six holes. I could have birdied all six of them. But it was pretty impressive. I ended up tied 13th going into the third round in my first Masters, which is impressive because most people miss the cut their first Masters because it takes a few years to learn that course. And my dad came in and when I walked in, he wasn't the sort to be like, oh, mate, and cuddles and all that. Oh, I am so proud. He is now like that. He wasn't then. And he couldn't speak. And he just said, that was the best. That was the best. And I was like, what? When I walked in, I was like, what? He was the best, that best. He couldn't get it out. That's all he could do. I was like, this is peculiar. And my mum was so happy. I remember seeing how happy she was. Like, it all been worthwhile. So anyway, on the Sunday when it all finished, I gave my mum a hug at the back of 18 at Augusta. I went on to Harbour Town for the next week's tournament, which I was going into the Saturday. After three rounds, I was in contention to win for the first time on the PGA Tour. And I come off and I had 15 missed calls from my brother. And I find out mum's had a heart attack. They'd gone back to Orlando at this stage. You need to come down. So pulled out the tournament, drove down there. In the end, her heart was fine, but we didn't know how long it had been since my dad had found her and started with CPR. And the question was how badly her brain might have been damaged, if it was damaged at all. But the CT scans were really positive, or the ECG scans, I think they call them, don't they? ECG scans. Yeah, they showed activity, which was great. So, she's going to wake up, fantastic. Everything's going to be great. And I was lucky enough that Nick Faldo, being a friend of mine, knew the best doctors, and I had airlifted to the right hospitals. It's one of the perks of, you know, being in that privileged position to be able to help someone like that. And you hope it's going to make the difference. Anyway, 2 days pass, and as anyone who knows who's been through anything like this, the time is a massively important thing. The longer it goes, the curve is quite steep at the end. So the next scan showed there was limited activity, and then the last scan on the sixth day, we had another scan, and it showed that she had no activity. And it was like a film. I remember the doctor coming in, and the bit that was most disconcerting about all was that the doctor cried. When he was crying when he told us, which is really weird when a doctor cries, because doctors aren't supposed to cry. You know, they're supposed to be the ones who deliver it too clinically and unemotionally, aren't they? And actually, he was really emotional. He just said, she's not coming back. She's not going to wake up. And my dad, bless him, was so businesslike about it. And so what do we do now then? What do we do? And he said, you don't do anything now. He said, we can keep her alive. And he was looking for the doctor to tell him, like, do we keep her alive or not? Mm. And doctors don't tell you that. And he did. He said, she's not coming back. She's not going to. If she does, she won't know who you are. She won't speak, eat, move. And thankfully, they talked about it, you know, as everyone does, because we've all seen those films, right? And like, what would you want? And, well, turn me off if I'm going to be like that. And so that's what we did. And she died within a minute. And then I literally fell off a cliff after that, really. And unfortunately, I was looking like I was going to make the Ryder Cup team that year. And in hindsight, it was the biggest mistake I made was making it very public. I did a press conference, I buried mum on a Tuesday, flew her home, buried her on a Tuesday. Instead of playing at Sawgrass in the Players' Championship, I played the Italian Open because I should have won it the year before. A couple of times I should have won it. And mummo's really wanted me to win the Italian Open for some reason, even though it's just a regular tournament on the European Tour. So I went there for her. It was all emotional already. Bad. It seemed right at the time, and I was thriving off it because it made me feel closer to her. And I did a press conference about my mum passing away, which was the weirdest thing. And it was all very public. And all the way through, and it came down to the last six holes and the last nine of the last event to make the team for the Ryder Cup. So it lasted the whole year, and I just missed it. Oh my. And Nick called me into the office. Faldo was the captain. And he said, look, I'm not picking you, but, you know, I want you to come with us as part of the team and be there. And I said no, because I think I was just emotionally spent. And then after that, I really did sort of... I think something kept me going, because there was a part of me, I was still, like, the Italian Open, I just buried my mum, I came top 10 because I was playing so well, but then I was just...
Well, just on adrenaline, yeah, or what?
Just because I was playing great golf, but this hadn't really hit home and what was going on. Yeah. And so I'd be like, in the first tee, I'm in floods of tears, teeing off in it. Mm. And then I'd just break down halfway around and start crying, and then I'd make a birdie. And then it was the weirdest vibe. It's not healthy what I was doing. And I made it my goal to make the Ryder Cup team for my mum, which was the massive mistake, because it became something that was beyond my control. Mm. And so many people wanted it for me as well. And I did so much damage that I probably paid the price for a lot after that. Mm. And the next year I won again. And where I lost my game wasn't until that next year when I won. And it was the end of my game was the day I won my last tournament, because I... had it in my head I was going to have this moment. And ironically, Martin Keimer, the year before, on the same green, in the same tournament, his mum had just passed away, and he pointed up to the sky, and I remember watching it. My mum was still alive at that time. No, it wasn't. It was the same time. It was right around the same time. I remember watching it. It wasn't long after Mum had passed away. And I remember Martin pointing up to for his mum and to the sky on the screen. And I was emotional about it because of, obviously, the what was going on. And also any person, he's a young man. He was a young man. He's younger than me, Martin. To lose your mum at that age, it's too young. He would have been probably 23. Mm. Terrible.
What were you, 25?
26. So it was really emotional. I thought, I thought I will have that moment. And ironically, it was the same tournament, the same green, same golf course. And I hold the putt to win, and it was to beat Bernard Langer and Retief Goosen. And I did the whole pointing up thing, and it was the most hollow thing because it was just like, it was going through the motions. I didn't feel anything because in the end, Mum's still dead. And actually, she just wanted me to be happy, and this wasn't making me happy. And I put myself through so much for this moment. It was so hollow. It was just so hollow. It didn't mean anything. We went out for drinks after. I thought, you know what? I played over 300 tournaments on the European Tour and I won three times. And winning three times puts you in a elevated tier of player because most people, to win once, okay, quite a few people win once. Still less than half. But then it drops off massively once you get to people who win twice to three times and then so on. See, it's not easy winning with 156 other competitors every week. And I thought, wow, this meant very little to me, and actually it was quite a sad day, and it really wasn't that easy to achieve, and I thought this is going to be a problem. And I remember being with the guys that night, and I never had a, let alone had a chance to win, I never came in the top 10 in a tournament again after that.
How quickly did you realise that this was a hollow, like the reflections that you had and that you're talking about now, how long did that take to kind of sink in and dawn on you?
Straight away.
Well, then at that night, I remember, because even with my dad, I remember speaking to my dad, and I don't know, I just, it's stupid. I don't know why, it made no sense, but emotionally it must have done. Like, I'm going to make it all right. I'll make it all right. I'll win this for us. Mm. It's like, great win, mate. But, you know, still, you're not going to see your mum. You know, and that I still find it really odd today, the idea that I can't speak to my mum. The terminal thing about someone passing away is the most hardest thing I've ever had to get my head around. But I think for me, the other big thing it led to was that really bad things could happen to me. And that whole mindset my dad had instilled in me as a kid of I was bulletproof. I really did believe I was bulletproof. Anything. If something bad happened, I would palm it off as in, well, that means something better is going to happen. And inevitably, I always did because that mindset is self-fulfilling, right? Mm. And all of a sudden, there's nothing good that happens off the back of that. There is no better outcome, is there? It's not like there's going to be, oh, your mum's going to come back and she'll be 10 years younger and healthier as well. Yeah. No, that's it. It's done. Yeah. And so I realised that bad things could happen. And I think then it started me on more of a negative spiral. And all of a sudden, and golf played in a negative way with a bad mindset is a bad place because it's hard. It's a really hard game.
Is that why Faldo didn't pick you? Did he see a vulnerability in you that, or did?
It was hard to get in that team anyway.
But could he pick you as his wild card though?
He could have done, and that's what he brought me in his office to tell me he wasn't going to pick me as his wild card. And
why not? Why do you think that?
Because there were other good players. I think he went with Poulter, and I can't remember who else he picked. He overlooked Casey as well, I think, for that one.
Did you feel a bit gutted about that? Because given that he was like your mentor.
No, because it would have been risky to pick me, and also I'd have been a rookie. And to pick a rookie is a big deal. And I think there was a few rookies in that team anyway. And I still had a chance. I very nearly made it by my own right in that last event still with all of it. And it would have been risky. It would have been a lovely thing to do. And obviously with our relationship, it makes it harder when you have those things because it would have looked like he was picking his... Someone were picking the kid he's looked after. Boy. Yeah. But he made the right... Well, it wasn't the right pick because we got battered. But the decision didn't bother me at all. It was a different thing altogether. You can't get sentimental about those things. You've got to do the right thing.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well,
HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And then, you know, really, it's fair to say your golf never really recovered, never got back to those glory
terrible
days.
Pinks.
Sorry.
It's beyond that. But that's what's wonderful about the job I do now, is that I know what it's like. Because I played with, the highlight of my career was playing with Tiger and going toe to toe with him at the US Open, and feeling comfortable, and it was just the best day of my career. Because you're playing with something, winning tournaments is one thing, but being around someone that you know he's Muhammad Ali, he's Michael Jordan, arguably more so potentially by the end of it all, if this comeback keeps coming, it's the gift that keeps on giving, Tiger Woods. But the most amazing things I've done in my career, and I've experienced at the top level, and I've been really good at this game. I've not been fearful of anyone, and I've also been fearful of myself, and terrified of taking the club back, and being absolutely bloody awful, and the worst of it being running out of golf balls in South Africa when I'd lost my card, and I'd been on the, I was 1 under after 6 holes in this tournament, on a really hard golf course at Fancourt, and on the 16th tee, I was 15 over, and I'd had 2 scores in double digits, and I had my last ball, and the caddy gave me my last, he said, "That's your last ball, mate." And I remember being stood over it, and I thought, I'd already lost one off that tee, so it's going to get worse than 15 over. Oh. And I thought, I can't shoot in the 90s, it's mortifying. I thought, if I lose this ball, I'll be disqualified, but that's better than having to shoot 90-something and everyone seeing it. And I thought, wow, that's, you're in a really good place if you think it like this. And of course, it spooned it off to the right-hand side, lost the ball, and the referee came. The referee didn't know what to say to me. He said, you're disqualified. I went, that's fine with me, mate. I said, which way to the clubhouse? Oh. And that was the bottom of the barrel, because the funny thing is, when it went wrong, the bottom of the barrel, I kept thinking I'd hit the bottom of the barrel, and it was nowhere. And it actually, I would have been devastated to know I was only halfway down at certain times. And it came to the yips with the drive. I got so scared of the game and of failing, and because I was failing so often, I was justifying why I was feeling like this, and it was snowballing out of control. And it got so bad that I didn't want to play. I didn't know how to take the club back, and I was so scared, and I would just quit on my swing on the way down because I was so scared, and it would just go miles offline, lose a ball. And it was the most horrific. When people would watch it, and you'd be like, oh my God. You know, it was like that. It'd take your breath away how bad it was. And I knew I was in trouble because it was in here. It was in my head. Yeah. Yes, it was manifesting itself in a technical way. And the other thing, I just changed all these coaches. And that's what I did when Mum died. I changed everything because I didn't want to deal with what was really happening. I started sacking people left, right and centre. Right, that's not working. Like Damien Taylor, Brendan Taylor was my manager all the time. We had a great little team, and I started just getting rid of people. Sorry, mate, that doesn't work anymore.
But was that the control freak in you just
I wanted to have something tangible that I could touch and feel, that I could be like, no, that doesn't work. This will work instead. Rather than going, look, no, you just, whoa. You know,
did you ever any stage ask yourself, say to yourself, look, clearly this is coming back to the massive trauma, the horrendous shock of losing your mum so young?
I just don't think I was ready. I just don't know what I would have done with it, though. I didn't like how it makes me feel. I'm from that sort of family where you just sort of, right, come on, let's go, let's get up and go again. And I did. And one thing Di would tell you actually throughout all of it, I'd be in tears loads of times, but I never woke up one day without feeling it. I'd bounce out of bed every morning, even in the bottom of the barrel. I was just like, right, today's the day. And I'm very proud of that, because that's not an easy, that's part of my character, which helped me get where I was. But I didn't have the answers. I didn't have the answers, and
surely you do, and you did, and you do have the answers.
It, well, I do
did
now.
All come. But okay, so when was that moment? When did that dawn on you? When did the penny drop?
When it wasn't what I did for a living anymore.
It took you to completely quit the game, yeah, to realise that this had all come down to losing
it
your
didn't
mum.
Matter. Yeah, well, I know. I knew what it came down to. I knew where the point was. I knew where it stemmed back to. But I didn't have to fix that. And I saw a lot of people about trying to fix it as well. I just think, you know, the biggest change for me was when I realised I was more than just a golfer. Because unfortunately, I was always very addicted to how my ego felt when. And it's huge as an individual in an individual sport to win and have that, because people treat you different. It's a bit weird, actually. Mm-hmm. And ironically, as I've got older, it's something I'm more uncomfortable with, because they're not real interactions, but I used to love it. When I was 19, 20, traveling around the world, and you know, it's just, I mean, you're living like a king. I mean, you're a rock star. Yeah. And it was the best thing ever. And it was so addictive. I mean, who doesn't want to feel like that? Yeah. But if you live like that, then when it goes wrong and people stop calling, and actually people, you're the guy, you're like, oh, there's the lad who just, you know, can't make a cut. And, you know, when you start to become that guy and people talk to you and that sort of, are you all right? Like, you've got an illness. You have to also embrace that, because that's where you live. It's all about your ego. So my foundation of what I was about wasn't built on anything that was, it was putrid underneath, unfortunately. And it took a long time for me to actually make peace with, you know what, I'm all right. I can live with both. I can live with this. And I made peace with the fact that, look, I had a good run. I did great things. I can't do it anymore. And then I found something else that I enjoyed. And, you know, Di was instrumental, really, in that, because she kept asking me, saying Jason Wesley from Golf at Sky, kept asking, would I like to go on and do a guest? And I'd always said no. Again, the ego saying no, because once I do that, that's like saying I'm 1 foot out the door, and yeah, I'm a pro golfer. I'm not a pundit. Yeah. You know, I don't talk about golf. I am a golfer. This is what I do. And it was stupid, really, because loads of guys had done it before me and done well. David Howell being one of them, Ollie Wilson, another one who'd done it. And I realised from the moment I did the very first ever show, it felt good for someone to actually go, oh, well done, mate. Thought you were great on there. It'd been a long time. It'd been 5 years since anyone had ever said anything to me about how well I'd done something, because it had constantly been negative stuff. So I think I really enjoyed it. And then when it came down, the opportunity of moving into it, the bit that I enjoy the most is not being a pundit. Presenting, I really enjoy, because it excites me, because it's a completely different job to what I used to do. Mm. Yes, my golfing background is a massive asset, and it's, you know, I can lean on it any given time, and my relationships within the game, and the fact that I have credibility from, I used to do what you do now, the person I'm looking at across from me and talking to. But the skill set is something brand new, and I really like that. It's like a brand new journey going a different direction, and it made it really easy, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're redefining yourself, which, as you say, is quite exciting. You probably needed that buzz that you hadn't had from golf for so long. You were getting elsewhere. You probably didn't know you could get it elsewhere.
No, I didn't. And that was a bit that was quite scary when I was struggling, because I thought, this is all I have. And at the same time, with young kids, I thought, I'm not going to spend all of this money that I've earned on me trying to, because it cost a bloody fortune. Like, I was spending hundreds of thousands, because I could be spending more on coaching than ever. But I'm not making any, I mean, I'm literally not making any money. And this is where I have a huge amount of admiration for, I was very lucky when I got on tour. I turned pro, I went straight to Q School, I got on tour, and I was on the main stage like that, done. And then when I lost my card, I had to go back to the Q School, and I was a very different man then, and in a very different part of their life, and it was very hard. And all I could notice was, oh my God, they're really good. These kids who can't make it, and they haven't got anything, and some of them to work other jobs as well, they're better than me. Like, they do exactly what I... And in my head, I just thought, well, they're not going to be as good as me, are they? And they are, and they still are. And, you know, that's the thing that made me realise how good some of these guys are that don't ever get the opportunity to have done what I did. And the difference is very different, and most of it's between the ears. And obviously, it was one of the negative things for me at the end, but it was also one of my biggest attributes when I was at my very best. So I think to move away from it was the right time for me, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, what a roller coaster, though, to get to that point. I mean, it must have been emotionally, financially, physically exhausting on every level.
It really was. But it made it easier because I really enjoyed what I was doing with Sky. I'd spoken to the bosses there, and I knew the vision for the future. So there was a plan. I like a plan. Mm. And it was an exit strategy. Yeah, I was, and I like control. Yeah. And I didn't have any of it. And I just felt like the right thing. And ironically, from the moment I made that commitment, golf became easy again. And like now I'll go and play. I played 2 days ago with some friends, and I had, for people who play golf, I had 13 chances on the West course at Wentworth, 13 chances inside 10 foot for birdie, which I wouldn't have done when I was playing at my very best. So as much as, okay, sometimes I'll hit terrible shots because I don't practice anymore and I play like 10 times a year. Actually, when you take away the disease that I had in the end between my ears that I'd helped grow and fed through that time, through the decisions I made, I could still play the game really well, and I enjoy it, but I still have no want. So I never ever go to a tournament out of a sky and think, oh yeah, I
want to get. You never feel that.
Which makes me feel that I just, it's definitely the right thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay, the Masters was a bit different when I was there, because it's just like, I mean, that's a bit special, and it did bring back all those memories. The last time I was there was the last time I saw my mum, so that was a weird feel, but also being there, it's a bit special. But yeah, I'm on a different track now, and I get so much more enjoyment doing what I do with Sky, and being able to tell the story rather than be part of it.
When you see what Tiger's done, the comeback of all comebacks, is there any part of you that thinks, well, he's proved that it can be done, so I could do the same?
You can't use people like Tiger Woods for that inspiration. yes, I absolutely see the point you're making. You can't do that. So you just can't do it. So my reason is, I'm a massive Tiger fan, and I don't mind doing it. And people criticise all the time, oh, you guys love Tiger. Yes, I do love Tiger, because I know him, I've played with him, and I've played my whole career watching him before I was there and after I've been there. He is still there doing what he was doing. What he did when he was at his very best was remarkable. To have gone through what he's gone through, and me also know what that feels like, but he had personal troubles. He also had huge physical troubles, which at one stage meant he couldn't walk, swing a golf club, couldn't walk.
Lost a parent.
And then his golf game, which included chipping yips, couldn't keep it on the golf course with his driver. It's quite a lot, that. And the thing that makes it even harder for Tiger is, some people say, well, that was his advantage, though, he knows he's got it. You don't, though, because when he was really good, he was untouchable, and everyone felt like, including myself, the reason he won so many tournaments because we all thought he was superhuman. Once he hits the front, that's it. It's game over. Can't get past him once he's at the front. And you expected him to do superhuman things. And I'm a big believer in that self-fulfilling prophecy. And he, I think, achieved so much because the vibe around him and in his head was, I make these putts when no one else makes them. And you think, oh, this would be incredible. He chipped, like the chip in at 16 at Augusta in 2005. And there's hundreds of those moments, though, for Tiger. You not go, oh, it was that shot. No, there's so many of those shots in his career. But to then fall off the face of the earth and it be over, and to a degree disgraced in some people's minds, on and off the golf course, oh, what a shame, the fallen hero, and everyone's saying it's over, including me. And I'm one of his biggest fans. He was all over. And I'm thinking, my actual take was, I hope he retires and doesn't become the guy that everyone gets to beat. Because when I played, it really meant something. I beat him once in one tournament in the entire time. All of those times I played with Tiger in tournaments he played, I beat him one time. And it was at the Open in 2009. And he missed the cut and I didn't. But only one time. I beat him over rounds of golf loads of times, but only once in a whole tournament. And if you beat him, it really meant something. And if you beat him, it usually meant you won the tournament, because if he didn't win, he came second or third. He was that good. So everyone now was taking his scalp. And that used to really pain me. I was like, he's too good for that.
Yeah.
And I need to remember him. I want to remember him as the legend and the hero that he was. I don't want to see him like fall over at the end and someone have to pick him up and carry him across the line. So that's no interest to me, because he's too... I like him as I remember him.
Yeah, but that's the hardest thing, isn't it, for a sportsman or woman, to know when the right time is to retire. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's near on impossible, and
well, I
knew, you know, when it's wrong.
They effectively took my job off me and kicked me out the door. But they, but yes, I hear exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And he obviously wasn't ready. And he'd say all these things like, you know, I'm just one day at a time. And, oh, God, it's painful. I can't listen to it anymore. And then last year he wins the Tour Championship. And it's like he's like the Pied Piper coming down the 18th hole. The fans, it was the most surreal thing to watch on TV. And the effect of him is golf as well. People didn't used to watch golf.
No.
you know, with all due respect to Jack Nicklaus and Nick Faldo, you know, from a British standpoint, obviously Nick and Jack are very different things, but it didn't Paul put bums on seats? Oh, Palmer did to a degree, but not, well, he did a lot. He revolutionised how we see sport, golf as a sport, but still, the general public didn't tune in to watch golf other than the Masters, maybe the Open and the Ryder Cup. Tiger's a different ball game. He transcends the sport. He is bigger than the sport, which is a and loads of people disagree with me saying that, but he is bigger than the sport because people who have no interest in golf have an interest in Tiger Woods.
100%.
And if you have an interest in golf, you definitely also have an interest in Tiger Woods. You might not always love him, and you might want to root against
him. I think
him.
That's part of it. I think that's part of the box office. Yeah. And, you know, it's the same for us in Formula One with Lewis Hamilton. He's on the front and back pages. There's very few sportsmen that can achieve that. And that is what draws you in. You become part of the soap opera. And, you know, there's elements of their lives that you don't agree with. But, you know, you've got an opinion because it matters. And for some reason, everyone wants an opinion. And that's when you know you've got a true icon.
I agree with that, and you're right, he does hit both sides of the paper as well. And I think the thing is about this one at the Masters is it was all over, and now all of a sudden we're dreaming that he might beat Jack's record at 43 years of age. He's three behind now, and it's realistic. And the next major's coming up, and it's at a golf course that he's won at Bethpage Black, and then the major after that, he's also won at that golf course as well. So,
and again, it goes back to your idea of self-fulfilling prophecy, that you do in some way feed off the confidence others have in you, not just that you have in yourself.
Absolutely. And the weird thing is, people were saying, who really know about the sport as well, and that's the amazing thing, is that a bit about Tiger that really gets everyone, is that people who know the game, you know, like social media is a great place to watch what people say about sports, if you know about your sport. Now, other sports I don't know about, so I'd read what someone say about football, and, oh, that sounds interesting, but football, someone who knows the game, Gary Neville, for instance, would go, oh, God almighty, you read some of the stuff. I read that about golf all the time.
Yeah.
People say the most ridiculous stuff about golf. But people who do know about golf said what turned out to be ridiculous things about Tiger Woods, because we were all wrong. All of these people who know all this stuff and all this experience and all this wisdom was wrong about Tiger Woods.
This is why I'm not giving up on you.
That's why I said you can't use it, because there's only one Tiger Woods. And I don't think there'll ever be another one either.
I'm sure.
But I think he's not done yet. I think he'll probably go on to win more majors now. And I mean, it's brilliant for golf.
Oh, it's a brilliant story of humanity as well. I mean, it's as you say, the sort of story you'll be telling your grandchildren and their grandchildren.
Well, that was the
decades.
Thing for them, wasn't it? Because I think for the bit about the Masters was the people my age who grew up as kids watching Tiger 1997 win the Masters, his first major, who are now sat with their kids, like mine, Max, watching him do it again now. It's like the next generation getting to feel exactly what I felt back in the 90s when Tiger first came and hit the scene. So, he's amazing. And, you know, we're lucky that we've still got him. It's great for our sport.
Yeah. Back to you for a moment. When your mum went, when she died, how did it affect the dynamic with your father, given that the peacemaker was now no longer part of the equation?
It was hard, but I think over time it's brought us closer together because it's softened. We've sort of embraced mum's mentality and how we've interacted. And I think, ironically, since I retired, Dad and I have gotten great, because we had that chat where I said, look, I think he always felt responsible for, I'm the one who really pushed you into being a golfer, and I promised you this. So he always felt it was his duty to make sure it went well. So when it went wrong, he was trying to get involved, and I didn't want him to get involved. And I wasn't in a good place, and we had some pretty good arguments, like good ones. And I think out the back of it, we spoke, and I effectively said at the end, look, it's my responsibility. This is what I'm doing. You did great. You achieved what you want. And I've had a wonderful life doing that. And what I do now is on the back of that. You know, everything in my life is on the back of it. Where I live, my wife, my children, what I do for my living. Everything I do is because of the sport that he introduced me to. So there's no regrets, and I really don't. And that was a fit, but I thought will I always feel, because I find it really hard to not finish things off in my life, and yet that one I thought, oh, and I don't know if I'll be able to live with that because I haven't finished that off. But what is finishing it off? I came back 3 years after not being able to get the ball off the tee and finished playing four tournaments a year because I couldn't get in anything else, and also doing bits for Sky, not really playing properly anymore, and finished, I was in contention at the Dunhill, and I finished in the top 30, which in itself was a monumental comeback from a player who couldn't get it off the tee, like literally terrified to take the club back because it would go sideways off the face, to be in the top 30 in a European Tour event again. In its own way, there you go, you beat the game, you got back, and you managed to take control over the sport again. And but winning, yeah, it'd be lovely, but you know, to a degree, if someone said to me now, look, you can have it all back, you can go back out there and be a pro golfer again, I just don't know if I want it, because it's a life that is so selfish, and I mean it with no disrespect to the guys who are good at it, because, and I have a huge admiration for guys with families who make that work, but it's all about you. You're the CEO and you call the shots, and you have to be ruthless all of the time, with your time as well. And you might play 23, 25, 28, even 30 tournaments some of the guys play a year, but at least another 12 weeks of that will be proper practice time, if not more. So actually, when you bear it down to, and then you've got all your corporate bits and bobs, actually your spare time to just be the family guy or go and hang out with your girlfriend or do whatever it is that you do, it's a very small amount of time. Yeah. And so they have to play the role of support staff to a degree. And I'm not prepared to do that because it's just not really how I'm built with my family. So where it is now with TV, red light, and you know what this feels like. Red light goes off, I'm off. I never think about it. And that's one of the things I love about it. I used to spend my entire life thinking about how I could do it better. How will I improve that? What do I need to do? And maybe that's where I came unstuck because I overthought it all. But with TV, I go, right, okay, what are we doing? And I go home, I'm off. You know, I don't go back and sit there and think, oh, I should have done that. Because I realise that, God, moment to moment, live TV, this is, things go wrong. And actually what makes it fun is how you get your way out of it and like how I fixed it. Oh, I did well there and that went wrong, or there was a problem back in the gallery and I had to pick up and do that. And I really enjoyed that. And actually some of the most fun of doing the whole thing is that, right? Rather than, you know, the really simple bits. But
I think therein lies your closure with and you can be at peace with your game because you have now carved out this new niche for yourself in life that does give you a thrill of a slightly different kind, but one that, you know, is, I don't know, giving you your mojo back in a way, really.
Yeah, it has. I think it's, the amazing thing is now is that so often, so I get guys, Tommy Fleetwood said it to me, and Rosie said it as well, Justin said it when I saw him at the, bless him, at the Masters, he came in and, so my first day of doing the Masters, and I'd said to him, look, it's my first time in the main seat. I could do with a bit of help. You know, it'd be nice if you lads came in, because that doesn't normally happen. And thinking, it's the night before the first major of the year. And then I know what the guys are doing, the work they do. They all came. I was really, really mad. I got quite emotional about when they all turned up as well. And they're like, yeah, I'm in. And Justin as well, because Justin's, you know, he's world number one at the time. So, but he came in, bless him, he gave me this pep talk. And he said to me, and I'm mic'd up so everyone can hear what he's saying as well. He goes, now look, this is your little pep talk. He says, all this stuff that came before doesn't matter now, right? He says, this is what you're made to do. He said, they're here because of you. This is why you're here doing this, because of you. Not because you used to play golf, because of what you do and how you do it, and you'll do great. And I'm like, thanks, mate. And I'm trying to cover it up on it. It was so sweet. And I think that's one of the great things that I've got closure from, is that I actually think that I'm not there yet by any means, but I think by the end of it all, I'll probably be remembered as a broadcaster rather than a professional golfer. And funny enough, it happens sometimes now. People sort of don't really realise what I did when I played. You know, I mean, the guys out there do in my world, in that really small world, but the people that you see, and especially younger people, they're like, no idea, because I wasn't even on tour when they really got to.
Do you know what? I'm going to compare you to Gary Lineker now, because there'll be a younger generation that doesn't remember ever watching him play football, but he's a brilliant broadcaster and he has carved that niche for himself. There are the pundits are plenty and there's some brilliant ones out there, but as you say, to make the transition from a player to a presenter with that bed of credibility and knowledge just as your sort of foundations, if you like, that's a very different thing altogether.
Yeah, it is actually. And I think he's a great example for someone. I admire Gary because I think he's really great at what he does. And he's really good at not letting people realise just how great he was, because he was one of the very best. Lineker was an amazing player. You know, and like the whole thing the other night with Barcelona as well. And it was like, why is he getting excited? Because he used to play for them. that's how good he was. But yeah, I think that's what's exciting about it was when I was just being the guest, it sort of reminded me of playing. It's like I'm here as Nick Doherty, the golfer.
Yeah.
Which, and it's great fun. It's the easiest job.
It is a bit limited, I think.
It is limited.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing as well is that you have a shelf life, right? Because then there's someone who's younger. There's someone who was like me going through, who's younger and just come off tour, and they're like, oh my God, right, I need to make room on the seat. And the next minute you haven't got a seat. And
the only thing is, you can be more opinionated as a pundit than a presenter.
To a degree. But the funny thing is with, yes, absolutely, of course you can. But I think we have permission because of our background. The great thing is, and it's also a curse, I always know the answer to the question that I'm asking.
Yeah.
I don't always know what they're going to say because they won't always agree with me. Yeah. But I'll always know. And it only ever takes me off guard is if they say something that is off the wall. Yeah, but that's not right.
Yeah, you see, I definitely don't have that luxury. I quite often ask questions where I don't know the answers. And I'm asking the question of Martin Brundle, Damon Hill, because, you know, I need their experience. They've sat in a car, they've driven a car, they've won races in a way that I never have.
Though, I think that's an asset because I can come unstuck because I drive it too much, because I know exactly where I want it. That answer will lead to this, to lead to this, because I'm going to ask him that and then this. I know exactly where I want to go with it. But sometimes they won't see it the way I see it. And I have to make peace with the fact that that's not how Paul sees this.
And the control freak in you has to back down.
Yeah, and that's fine. And Robert Lee has the same thing for us in Sky as well, because Rob obviously has a background. He will give an opinion and I will give an opinion as well.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's about their voice and what they really feel about it. But it is interesting. But I think sometimes not knowing the answer can be nice, because that's what the person is at home, right? Your viewer is sat there not knowing the answer.
No, trust me, F1 fans back home know more. Yeah, they know a lot. I tell you what, super geeks. Yeah, absolutely. I think we've got this lovely kind of community. It's like a family. Everyone calls it the F1 family. But wow, I tell you what, if you get a stat wrong, you will have 20 tweets within a second telling you, actually, in 1984, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my God. Have a day off. I suppose it is. I don't think social media is great fun, but all good for you for saying it.
Listen, the last hour has flown by. What the listeners won't know is that your darling wife Di is actually looking after all four of our children right now, so it's going to be carnage out there. Should we just stay in here and have some dinner?
I think we should go have a few drinks. Just so.
Oh my God, and here they come, right on cue, and they're walking in. And Nick, thank you so much for your time. Hi, guys. Thank you for your time. I can't believe they walked in right at that point.
Why has she got rosy cheeks? Why have they both got...
Been putting some makeup on.
Nick, thank you so much.
Thanks, Pix. My pleasure.
That is so funny that you walked in there.
Really?
We were just talking about you.
Oh, amazing.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.